Aren't we taught to think for ourselves in America? The nature of Bush administration informational propaganda, frankly, is not to overly tax our thinking. Remember, this is the president. This is the president who's all about rolling back taxes, and that includes rolling back taxing our thinking and or causing too much antagonistic emotional responses. Rather, the citizenry far too often is instructed to behave itself as if the administration's behavior and attitudes are its own. In particular, the regular hammering of the Iraq 9/11 link served effectively to create, for a time, as I said, a herd-like response among many American citizens. We were conditioned to want to believe that what the government was telling us was true, even with no visible proof, because the alternative, remember the alternative presented to us, was enemy propaganda and control. And that was too devastating to consider. We shut ourselves down to thinking for ourselves whenever any government directs its populace to think alike on such a major issue like safety and security that affects us all. This is what can make such propaganda so insidious and paternalistic. The worst propagandists view their target audience with a great deal of disdain. And sadly, I think a lot of our leadership in this country has had a rather disdainful view of the citizenry. But as I said, I had good news, and that is that we've come together as citizens. We're thinking for ourselves, and we've made a lot of progress. Let's go back in time to a period when we had a lot of subversion of the press with patriotic propaganda in its place. A Chicago Council on Foreign Relations poll in June 2002 showed that among those Americans surveyed, just 20% said the following: the U.S. should invade Iraq even if we have to go it alone, just 20%, while an overwhelming majority said that the U.S. should only invade Iraq with U.N. approval and the support of its allies. It was clear that while the American people were open to the overthrow of the despotic Saddam Hussein, the clear method for such overthrow was to favor a multilateral response for Iraq. To support its own agenda, the Bush administration set out to, frankly, frighten us into believing that Saddam Hussein's government was preparing to use weapons of mass destruction, imminent threat against the United States. Less than 9 months later, the American people had shifted their support for unilateral war on Iraq. The president was given a blank check to engage in a military invasion and now occupation of Iraq. In 2003, just as a reminder, I'm sure we'll all remember this, the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland, PIPA, teamed up with a polling firm to investigate misperceptions about Iraq and the role of the media. And what they found is that The PIPA survey showed a strong correlation between one's media source and the likelihood to misperceive. The most closely aligned national news channel with the Bush administration, Fox News Channel, was the channel where a majority of viewers held at least one misperception, 80%, followed by CBS News and ABC News. So I often say, it's not enough to just make Fox News the enemy. In a lot of progressive circles, there's a lot of gnashing of teeth about Fox News. The media system as a whole, we need to keep them honest and keep nipping at their heels. The least likely group to hold at least one of these misperceptions was the National Public Radio listener or public broadcasting. Okay, nobody's perfect, but 77% of these viewers and listeners did not identify one misperception, while only 20% of the Fox News Channel viewer did. These media source surveys by PIPA show clear evidence of the Bush administration leading by falsehood and deception and then courting a patriotic mainstream media, still reeling from 9/11, as we all were as a public as well. I'm going to go along. I've got my entire chapter here, but I want to make it very quick. When the American press, where was the American press, really, the question is, to challenge the executive branch of government? The PIPA surveys indicate a media system where plenty of networks, not just Fox News, reported their news in a Bush-friendly manner. And of course, there's historic precedents for this. A number of historians in the Academy are doing great work and showing parallels with this sort of rallying around the flag syndrome that the press tends to enact during wartime. The period after 9/11 led to enormous patriotic zeal inside newsrooms across America. CBS News anchor Dan Rather said on Larry King Live, April 4, 2003, "Look, I'm an American. I never tried to kid anybody that I'm some internationalist or something. And when my country is at war, I want my country to win." Now, I can't and don't argue that that is coverage without a prejudice. About that, I am prejudiced, said Rather. This was a position, of course, extended at Fox News. Throughout the initial engagement of the war in Iraq, we all remember Fox News Channel, including a flag in the left-hand corner of the screen that showed agreement with the Defense Department's name for the war in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom. When Fox was later criticized for being too pro-war in its news coverage, Fox News Channel moderator Neil Cavuto replied, "So am I slanted and biased? You damn well bet I am. You say I wear my biases on my sleeve? Better that than pretend you have none, but show them clearly in your work," he said. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist CNN reporter Peter Arnett was fired in March 2003 for violating the patriotic press creed. That is, he told the truth to Iraqi state television, quote, that the first war plan of the Bush administration has failed because of Iraqi resistance. Now they are trying to write another war plan. Clearly the war planners misjudged the determination of Iraqi forces, said Arnett. Around the same time, we'll never forget, she's now on Court TV. I guess that's a safe place for her. MSNBC reporter Ashley Banfield was subsequently dismissed for telling a college audience the following about press coverage of the Iraq War, which she had covered extensively since the start. Here was her quote from her speech. "There are horrors that were completely left out of this war. So was this journalism or was this coverage? There is a grand difference," she said, "between journalism and coverage. And getting access does not mean you're getting the story. It just means you're getting one more arm or leg of the story. And that's what we got. And it was a glorious, wonderful picture that had a lot of people watching and a lot of advertisers excited about cable news. But it wasn't journalism, because I'm not so sure that we in America are hesitant to do this again, to fight another war, because it looked like a glorious and courageous and so successful, terrific endeavor. And we got rid of a horrible leader. We got rid of a dictator. We got rid of a monster. But we didn't see what it took to do that." In response, her employer, NBC, issued a terse statement which read, "She and we agreed that she didn't intend the work of her colleagues, and she will choose her words more carefully in the future." A study conducted by FAIR, and let's hear it for FAIR and their good work. I hope throughout the weekend that we'll be giving each other a lot of attagirls, attaboys, and really acknowledge all the great work of these independent organizations. FAIR found that pro-war commentary dramatically overshadowed anti-war commentary at the start of the war in Iraq. Steve Rendell and Tara Bruhel revealed the percentage of U.S. sources that were officials varied from network to network, ranging from 75% at CBS to 60% at NBC. Fox's special report with Britt Hume had fewer U.S. officials than the others. This volume of pro-war commentary corresponds with this tendency for the Bush administration to reinforce misperceptions about the war. I've only got 2 minutes, so I'm going to go straight ahead to the where we're going in terms of what I think is less discussed when it relates to propaganda, and that is what is happening inside the Pentagon and the Defense Department. This is really crucial. Rumsfeld may have stepped down, but there is still this information operations roadmap. And what we're seeing in the future is looking at all of the new media as part of the full spectrum of military domination. And this really greatly concerns me, because for all of the work that I did at USIA, in terms of public diplomacy. That was $1 billion worth of work a year that we did in comparison to the budget at the Pentagon, which is, what, $400 billion. That's just for the overall Defense Department budget. But so much of the information roadmap material now includes a strategy for taking over the Internet and controlling the flow of information and viewing, frankly, the World Wide Web as a potential military adversary. If the Internet is viewed by the administration as equal to an enemy weapon, it may be difficult or more difficult for web-based activists to get across their messages and organize counter-social movements without fears of reprisal, surveillance, and feelings of restraint. And I point you to a Council on Foreign Relations speech that Rumsfeld gave in February, in which he talks about, his famous quote was, "For the most part, the U.S. government still functions as a five-and-dime store in an eBay world." And so he called for this increase in the militarization of the information spectrum. I'm going to leave it at that, and I thank you for your attention.
That was Nancy Snow, Associate Professor of Communications at Cal State Fullerton. Our last speaker from the Media Reform Conference has been heard on this program before. He is sociologist Peter Phillips, the director of Project Censored, based at Cal State Sonoma. Project Censored publishes an annual investigation of the top unreported or underreported stories in the press, as well as other research related to media, society, and politics. Phillips is one of the only widely respected progressive media figures to take on the lies surrounding the official story of 9/11. And at the end of his presentation, you'll hear panel moderator Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy try to unsuccessfully whip him into line.
We've been talking about public relations and PR firms, and we've examined the PR industry. In our current book, we talk about how PR has consolidated massively since 2001. And there's now three big publicly traded mega corporations, Omnicom, WPP, and Intergroup, and Interpublic Group. And they employ 163,000 people in over 170 countries. And these are huge, monstrous firms. Like WPP, which is based in the UK, has an impressive list of subsidiaries, some that are well-known, Young and Rubicam, Burson Marsellers, Ogilvy and Mather Worldwide, and Helen Nolan are now part of WPP. Helen Nolan, of course, was the ones that brought us the incubator baby story during the first Gulf War. And we're seeing interpenetration between these big PR firms and corporate media. Four members of WPP sit on the Council of Foreign Relations. Also, this Omnicom board has members on Time Warner and also on PBS. So as PR has consolidated, we've seen also the consolidation of corporate media. Everybody knows Ben Bagdikian's work, and when Project Censored started 30 years ago, 50 major media corporations, now down to 10. So what we're seeing is the interlocking between public relations firms, mega public relations firms, and corporate media worldwide. And we see an expanded spending by the U.S. government. So the Waxman Report, as of July of 2005, from GOA, had the number on that the Bush administration was spending in the previous 2 years of $1.6 billion, and that was $1 billion in the Defense Department on PR and on advertising, which was a massive increase over what had been going on in the Clinton administration. They were still doing it then, but the amount of money spent is hugely increased since that time. So and then you have specialty groups like the Rendon Group, which helped Clinton during the war, the bombing of Serbia, and continues to help the Pentagon today in terms of how we manage wars. They did Panama. They kind of do specialize in wars, and so they were the ones that gave us the Jessica Lynch story, the day the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. Front pages in the paper were about Jessica Lynch instead of what was really going on in Baghdad with the shelling of the Palestine Hotel and the bombing of Al Jazeera. So the success of this merger, really, between big PR firms and corporate media has been particularly effective post 9/11 in terms of creating kind of a public cultural bias, so that we now have, we've had the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, we have the Patriot Act, we have Homeland Security, with large public support, certainly initially, that says that there's a cultural bias imparted, and it's working effectively on the American population, that impacts people. So we know that, you know, two-thirds of people thought Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 initially. That's declined, and we've had to work very hard at that. So these kinds of understandings create biases within the public that do impact all media, and they impact our media as well, the media that we're here celebrating. And there's a case in particular that came up a year ago in October. It's in our book this year. It's about how ACLU, in October of 2005, released 44 autopsy reports that they had acquired from the military under the Freedom of Information Act. And these were autopsy reports of citizens, of private citizens who, in detention in Afghanistan and Iraq, had died. And these reports were completed by U.S. military doctors. And they, on 21 of the 44, the cause of death was listed as homicide. They were murdered while in custody. Now, the descriptions of their bodies, and you can still look at these. These are on the ACLU website. I mean, and it's horrendous reading. I mean, broken bones, contusions, lacerations, no defensive wounds. And, you know, they were, quite frankly, tortured to death. The other 23, the principal cause of death was heart failure. So they were tortured and their heart stopped. Now, these are only the ones that died. So we don't know how many other hundreds were, in fact, tortured and lived and are out there today still. But that was picked up by AP. And it went out to all 1,700 dailies in the country. It went out to all 5,000 radio and news programs. And less than a dozen actually ran the story. So, I mean, here was absolute proof that the U.S. had been torturing people to death in Afghanistan, Iraq, 2002, 3, and 4. And this was multiple agencies. I mean, this was the Marines, this was the CIA, this was private mercenaries. I mean, it was a lot of different people involved. So there was this, here's absolute proof. It gets one-day coverage, the largest being the L.A. Times on page A4. And that's it. It's never mentioned again. But it's also not picked up or used as an issue of torture, not only in corporate media, but in our media as well. And so it's, you know, so every, there's been lots of stories about torture, lots of stories about Abu Ghraib, which comes because we have the pictures. But, you know, in Abu Ghraib, like, nobody really died. It was embarrassing to them, and we've convicted a few privates and a corporal and that. So but this is policy. This is proof. So to us, that's a clear understanding of the bias, the reluctance to come forward with a story that really undermines the credibility of the United States, that we're out there torturing people to death in a very big way as a policy. And these are sensitive issues, and they're sensitive for all of us, including independent media. So, I mean, if we look back in the 10 years that I've been involved with Project Censored, you know, there's areas of cultural bias where stories are sensitive. Or there's a preset kind of ideas relative to the American public, and it makes independent media's job more sensitive, in some cases difficult to actually cover stories in really objective, balanced ways. I think Israel-Palestine relationships is one area that's been very sensitive. The Yugoslav war and the demonization of the Serbs in that process. I think one of the stories when we covered how, you know, the various sides of that issue back in 99 and when we were bombing Serbia, we got a lot of criticism. Like, why are you covering that? That's you know, their propaganda. But you have to sort through these stories and really sort of figure it out. The social movements in terms of immigrants' rights, impeachment, and or critical analysis of 9/11 or 9/11 Commission Report. Each of these are very sensitive areas and can become difficult to cover in objective ways. So we did a chart. Let's see. Can you show me where this is? We got this plugged in here. Six of our students spent last semester evaluating six key stories and how they're being covered or to what degree we've been covered in the independent press. Now the impeachment movement, as we look down on that, and this the impeachment idea as a social movement, we now have over 50%, last Logbe poll, 50% of the people believe that Bush Cheney should be impeached if they lied about the war in Iraq. So, I mean, the numbers are quite high. So, and we're getting fairly decent coverage on that. I mean, that's a fairly strong coverage, and not as extensive in terms of this is a social movement, all the different areas. But even the corporate media has covered, like in the state of New Mexico, the Democrats there voted for impeachment and... That's okay. You have hard copy. That's okay. But on the second, you can look at the hard copy because that just went out. We'll just go ahead. The impeachment question in terms of corporate media. Throughout the country, I mean, our city of Sebastopol, the city of Santa Cruz, I think, even in the county, San Francisco, state of New Mexico, there's been impeachment resolutions passed all over the country. Most of those have individually been covered by the corporate media to varying degrees. They've been AP stories. But there's been no AP story that says there's this massive impeachment movement in the United States and that, you know, that half the country is supporting that and that there's activists engaged in doing all this. And there's multiple impeachment books out, and we're seeing some reviews, but not much. And so it's sort of like it's not on the table, and that's certainly what the Democrats are saying today. Now, the Cuban Five is a little different situation. What we're finding here is the five Cubans who had been sent to infiltrate terrorist organizations in Miami that have been blowing up hotels in Havana. And they were arrested, they were charged with espionage, although it was never proven, and they're in jail, and their families can't come see them. We see very little coverage of that, even in the independent press. Voter fraud kind of mixed, particularly the issue of the 2004 election where 8 million votes were different in the exit polls than what were on the voting machines. And this only happened in 13 states. Most of the exit polls in 37 states matched the actual results. So 13 states where voting machines didn't have a paper trail, 8 million votes were different than what the exit poll said. Major fraud issue. There's no question in my mind that there was fraud in the 2004 election. And I think one that's most sensitive, and I don't have a lot of time left, but there's three areas of 9/11 issues. The pre-warnings has gotten mixed coverage in terms of independent press. The NORAD failures to intercept the jets has got actually less, but Democracy Now! Has had debates both on the 9/11 warnings and NORAD. So the cell that says no under NORAD should say yes, at least debate. For in terms of Democracy Now. The one that's really been ignored is Stephen Jones's work on Building 7, which now the Swiss Institute of Technology in Europe and two dozen chemists and physicists in the U.S. now support, is increasingly getting more support. It's a legitimate news story. There's a story of a scientist who's done tests and he's evaluated the collapse of Building 7. And he is convinced it didn't fall down from a fire. I mean, it's got 24 steel course thing frame that fell down simultaneously. And it collapsed in 6.6 seconds. He says fires just can't do that, that it had to have demolition help. So, I mean, what you've got here is a serious debate between scientists about a building that is unresolved, and it's a news story. And it needs to be covered. And we're finding very little coverage, even in our own independent press, on this as an issue, and in some cases, overt denial. So these are cultural biases. 9/11 is a very sensitive topic. And the idea that Al-Qaeda, you know, were the sole perpetrators, that Osama bin Laden was behind it all. The FBI doesn't even have Osama bin Laden listed for that as a crime. They want him for the bombings in Africa, not for 9/11, if you look at their website. So I'm going to conclude with that and simply say that we have a hypothesis, kind of a working hypothesis, and that is as PR and corporate media concentrate, they create cultural context pressures that impact all of us. So they can discredit authors, they can label authors as conspiracy theorists or as communists or whatever. And that these cultural pressures have impacts on independent press in those areas that are most sensitive and or most discredited, and they make it harder and something. So when those red flags go up, there's something we're not covering. We need to look at that extremely hard and try to be as objective and as impartial as possible in our analysis. Thank you.
Sorry about that technical glitch. I think it was, is Nancy who said we should, you know, pat each other on the back and so on and encourage each other. But I think we also need to question each other and hold each other accountable. Peter, on the 9/11 stuff, you were speaking specifically about Building 7, not about the two main towers. Can you clarify that? And don't you run the risk of falling into, I mean, there's the Bush line propaganda, but there is also other conspiratorial propaganda. So
sure.
Are you falling into the, you know, buying a whole other list of propaganda that just is a different stripe of disinformation?
We put chapters out on 9/11 unanswered questions, both in our 2006 book and our 2003 book. We don't have any theories about who did what. We just have these huge unanswered questions. Now, Building 7, from our own scientists at the university, and people have looked at this, is probably the strongest case for questioning as to what the official reports are. I mean, it wasn't even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. So to come forward and question that, particularly the speed of the building, 6.6 seconds, that's free fall speed. With zero resistance from many of the core structures, they all collapse simultaneously. So there's certainly a legitimate news story there to take a look at and to really examine for all of us.
You still think that, even though Popular Mechanics put out a thing that ordered to go through? And I'm asking him a question.
Well, you know what? It's right? Interesting. These are sensitive issues, and I've read the Popular Mechanics piece. I've talked to Stephen Jones about it. There's certainly disagreement in terms of a number of scientists. The Swiss Institute, two of their structural engineers came forward and says undoubtedly Building 7 had demolitions in it. I've stayed away from 1 and 2. There's people that believe that. We've certainly disproved the mini-nuke theory, that there were mini-nukes in it. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy, you know, theories out there about what happened or who did what. But, you know, as scholars, as journalists, as people who can critically look at issues, we need to be able to sort through that and not just dismiss it completely, and to be able to actually analyze and look at, well, what's credible, what evidence do we have? And in some cases, certainly in the science stuff, you need panels of experts to really examine that in an objective way. You need a dozen physicists and chemical engineers and that can sit down and say, well, let's look at the evidence and examine it. We don't have that. So I think the questions are still very much open.
Fearless truth seeker and scholar Peter Phillips of Project Censored, speaking at the National Conference on Media Reform. You can hear lots of great presentations and learn how to get involved in the media reform movement at freepress.net.
Cities are full of criminals. All of them are black. They'll shoot you for your shoes or to get a little crack. But the police are protecting us, locking up these thugs. making us all safer by being tough on drugs. There was a truck bomb in Baghdad, blew up the UN. These fanatics do not have care for innocent women and men. They don't like civilization, it's just destruction that they crave. There is no rhyme or reason for the way that they behave. It's hard to believe, but I know it's true. I saw it on the evening news. There's a war on in Colombia, and it's all about cocaine. The FARC is running drugs from Mexico to Maine. It's an ugly situation, but soon it will be whipped. We just need to send along more helicopter gunships. It's hard to believe, but I know it's true. I saw it on evening news. There was a bomber in Jerusalem, blew himself up on a bus. He was a funny-looking Muslim, not like one of us. He didn't like the Jews, and he says that God is great. I don't know what his problem is, he's just so full of hate. It's hard to believe, but I know it's true. I saw it on evening news. Evil men are plotting to blow up Washington, D.C. 'cause they don't like freedom and democracy. They're fans of the Dark Ages. They are all around. They're marching from the desert sand and coming to your town. It's hard to believe, but I know it's true. I saw it on evening news. It's hard to believe, but I know it's true. I saw it on evening news.
Last week, in our reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we began Chapter 9 that dealt with Taylorism, the ideas of scientific management that were designed to break the actions of the worker down into discrete parts that could be analyzed for maximum efficiency and output, and then to institute policies that would govern every move made by the worker during the workday, essentially turning that person into a machine. This concept of the efficient factory began to be applied to schooling as well, whose purpose was being broadly redefined through an aggressive media campaign as producing usable workers for business. Our section last week concluded with some examples of articles in the press of the time, criticizing the academic nature of public schools where students read Virgil and studied physics, calling it a fool factory. While the dean of Columbia Teachers College, James E. Russell, commented that if school cannot be made to drop its mental development obsession, the whole system should be abolished. School clearly was to have another purpose than mental development. So we'll pick up in Chapter 9. And Gatto writes, "To speak of scientific management in school and society without crediting the influence of the Fabians would do great disservice to truth. But the nature of Fabianism is so complex it raises questions this essay cannot answer. To deal with the Fabians in a brief compass, as I'm going to do, is to deal necessarily in simplifications in order to see how little this charming group of scholars, writers, heirs, heiresses, scientists, philosophers, bombazines, gazebos, trust fund babies, and successful men and women of affairs became the most potent force in the creation of the modern welfare state, distributors of its characteristically dumbed-down version of schooling. Yet pointing only to this frivolous organization's eccentricity would be to disrespect the incredible accomplishments of Beatrice Webb and her associates and their decisive effort on schooling. Mrs. Webb is the only woman ever deemed worthy of burial in Westminster Abbey. What 19th-century transcendentalists and Muggletonians hope to be in reordering the triumvirate of society, school, and family, 20th-century Fabians actually were. Although far from the only potent organization working behind the scenes to radically reshape domestic and international life, it would not be too far out of line to call the 20th century the Fabian century. One thing is certain. the direction of modern schooling for the bottom 90% of our society has followed a largely Fabian design. And the puzzling security and prestige enjoyed at the moment by those who speak of globalism and multiculturalism are a direct result of heed paid earlier to Fabian prophecies that a welfare state, followed by an intense focus on internationalism, would be the mechanism elevating corporate society over political society, and a necessary precursor to utopia. Fabian theory is the Das Kapital of financial capitalism. Fabianism always floated above simplistic politics, seeking to preempt both sides. The British Labour Party and its post-World War II welfare state are Fabianism made visible. This is well understood. Not so easily comprehended are the signs of an aristocratic temper, like this little anti-merocratic Fabian gem found in a report of the British College of Surgeons. Quote, "Medicine would lose immeasurably if the proportion of such students from upper-class and upper-middle-class homes were to be reduced in favor of precocious children who qualify for subsidies, i.e. scholarship students." Even though meritocracy is their reliable cover, social stratification was always the Fabian's real trump suit. Entitlements are another Fabian insertion into the social fabric, even though the idea antedates them, of course. To realize the tremendous task Fabians originally assigned themselves, a significant part of which was given to schooling reform, we need to reflect again on Darwin's shattering books, The Origin of Species in 1859 and The Descent of Man in 1871, each arguing in its own way that far from being blank slates, children are written upon indelibly by their race of origin, some favored in Darwin's language, some not. A powerful public relations initiative of recent years has attempted to separate Darwin from social Darwinism, but it cannot be done because Darwin himself is the prototypical social Darwinist. Both books taken together issued a license for liberal upper classes to justify forced schooling. From an evolutionary perspective, schools are the indoctrination phase of a gigantic breeding experiment. Working-class fantasies of self-improvement were dismissed from the start as sentimentality that evolutionary theory had no place for. What Darwin accomplished with his books was a freeing of discussion from the narrow straitjacket it had worn when society was considered a matter of internal associations and relationships. Darwin made it possible to consider political affairs as a prime instrument of social evolution. Here was a pivotal moment in Western thought, a changing of the guard in which secular purpose replaced religious purpose, long before trashed by the Enlightenment. For the poor, the working classes, and middle classes in the American sense, this change in outlook, lauded by the most influential minds of the 19th century, were a catastrophe of titanic proportions, especially for government school children. Children could no longer simply be parents' darlings. Many were biologically a racial menace. The rest had to be thought of as soldiers in genetic combat, the moral equivalent of war. For all but a relative handful of favored families, aspiration was off the board as a scientific proposition. For governments, children could no longer be considered individuals, but were regarded as categories, rungs on a biological ladder. Evolutionary science pronounced the majority useless mouths waiting for nature to dispense with entirely. Nature, as expressed through her human agents, was to be understood not as cruel or oppressive, but beautifully, functionally purposeful, a neo-pagan perspective to be reflected in the organization and administration of schools. Three distinct and conflicting tendencies competed in the 19th century theory of society. First was the empirical tendency stemming from John Locke and David Hume, which led to that outlook on the study of society we call pragmatism, and eventually to behavioristic psychology. The second line, descended from Immanuel Kant, Hegel, Savigny, and others, led to the organic theory of the modern state, the preferred metaphor of Fabian's and many later systems theorists. The third outlook comes to us out of Rousseau, Diderot, D'Alembert, Bentham, and the Mills, and leads almost directly to the utilitarian state of Marxist socialism. Each of these postures was savagely assailed over time by the development of academic Darwinism. After Darwin, utopia as a human-friendly place dies an agonizing death. The last conception of utopia after Darwin, which isn't some kind of hellish nightmare, is William Morris' News from Nowhere. With only niggling reservations, the Fabian Brain Trust had no difficulty employing force to shape recalcitrant individuals, groups, and organizations. Force, in the absence of divine injunctions, is a tool to be employed unsentimentally. Fabian George Bernard Shaw established the principle wittily in 1920 when he said that under a Fabian future government, quote, you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly fed, clothed, lodged, taught, and employed whether you liked it or not. If it were discovered that you have not character and industry, you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner. From the Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism. Fabianism came into existence around the year 1884, taking its name from the Roman general Fabius Cunctator, who preserved the Roman state by defeating Hannibal, chipping away at Hannibal's patience and will to win by avoiding combat. Darwin was the weird holy man Fabians adored, the man who gave them their principle, a theory inspirationally equal to God theory, around which a new organization of society could be justified. Society after Darwin was incontrovertibly about good breeding. That was the only true goal it had, or scientifically could have. Before Darwin, the view of historical development, which fit best with Anglo-American tradition, was a conception of individual rights independent of any theory of reciprocal obligations to the state. The duty of leaders was to society, not to government, a crucial distinction in perfect harmony with the teachings of Reformation Christianity, which extended to all believers a conception of individual duty, individual responsibility, and a free will to decide for oneself beyond any claims of states. John Calvin proclaimed in his Institutes that through natural law, the judgment of conscience alone was able to distinguish between justice and injustice. It's hard for secular minds to face, but the powerful freedoms of the West, unmatched by any other society at any other time, are rooted deeply in a religion so radical, so demanding, it revolts the modern temper. For Protestant Christians, salvation was uniquely a matter between God and the individual. The mind of Northern Europe had for centuries been fixed on the task of winning liberties for the individual against the state. Notable individual freedoms were taken from the state, beginning symbolically at Runnymede in 1215. By 1859, 6.5 centuries later, in the age of Darwin, individual rights were everywhere in the Anglo-Saxon world, understood to transcend theories of obligation to the state. Herbert Spencer embodies this attitude, albeit ambiguously. For Spencer, Darwinian evolution promised rights only to the strong. It is well to keep in mind that his brief for liberty masks a rigorously exclusionary philosophy, particularly when he sounds most like Thomas Paine. The First and Second Amendments of our own Constitution illustrate just how far this freedom process could carry. Say what you please before God and man. Protect yourself with a gun, if need be, from government interference. Spencer was the reigning British philosopher from 1870 to 1900. In the Westminster Review of January 1860, he wrote, "The welfare of citizens cannot rightly be sacrificed to some supposed benefit of the state. The state is to be maintained solely for the benefit of the citizens. The corporate life in society must be subservient to the lives of its parts, instead of the lives of the parts being subservient to the corporate life." Spencer had an even greater vogue in America, influencing every intellectual from Walt Whitman to John Dewey and becoming the darling of corporate business. Early in 1882, a grand dinner was held in his honor by the great and powerful who gathered to hear scientific proof of Anglo-Saxon fitness to rule and a brief for moral relativism. The dinner and its implications set the standard for 20th century management, including the management of schooling. A clear appraisal of the fateful meal and its residence is given in E. Digby Baltzel's The Protestant Establishment, a well-bred look at the resurgence of the Anglican outlook in America. This attitude constituted a violent contradiction of German strong state, state as parent doctrine, which held that interests of the individual as individual are without significance. But the derogation of individual rights was entirely consistent with Darwinian science. The German authoritarian preference received an invigorative restorative with Darwin's advent. Natural selection, the operational principle of Darwinism, was held to reach individuals only indirectly through the action of society. Hence, society becomes a natural subject for regulation and intervention by the state. To illustrate how reverberant a drum the innocent-sounding locution natural selection can really be translated into social practice, try to imagine how denial of black dignities and rights and the corresponding degradation of black family relationships in America because of this denial might well be reckoned an evolutionary positive course in Darwinian terms. By discouraging Negro breeding, eventually the members of this most disfavored race would diminish. The state not only had a vested interest in becoming an active agent of evolution, it could not help but become one willy-nilly. Fabians set out to write a sensible evolutionary agenda when they entered the political arena. Once this biopolitical connection is recognized, the past, present, and future of this seemingly bumbling movement takes on a formidable coherence. Under the dottiness, lovability, intelligence, high social position, and genuine goodness of some of their works, the system held out as humanitarian by Fabians is grotesquely deceptive in reality. Fabian compassion masks a real aloofness to humanity. It is a purely intellectual project in scientific management. Thomas Davidson's History of Education, seen through this lens, transmutes in front of our eyes from the harmlessly addled excursion into romantic futurism, it seems to be, into a manual of frightening strategic goals and technical methods. Fabians emerged in the first years of the 20th century as great champions of social efficiency in the name of the evolutionary destiny of the race. This infused a powerful secular theology into the movement, allowing its members to revel privately in an ennobling destiny. The Fabian program spread quickly through the best colleges and universities under many different names, multiplying its de facto membership among young men and women blissfully unaware of their induction. They were only being modern. H.G. Wells called it the open conspiracy in an essay bearing the same title, and worth your time to track down. As the movement developed, Fabians became aristocratic friends of other social efficiency vanguards like Taylorism, or allies of the Methodist social gospel crowd of liberal Christian religionists, busy substituting works for faith in one of the most noteworthy religious reversals of all time. Especially, they became friends and advisors of industrialists and financiers, travelers in the same direction. This cross-fertilization occurred naturally, not out of petty motives of profit, but because by Fabian lights, evolution had progressed furthest among the international business and banking classes. These laughing gentry were impressively effective at whatever they turned their hands to because they understood the principles of social leverage. Kitty Muggeridge writes, "If you want to pinpoint the moment in time when the very first foundation of the welfare state was laid, A reasonable date to choose would be the last fortnight of November in 1905, when Beatrice Webb was appointed to the Royal Commission on the Poor Law, and she convinced her protege, Albert Beveridge, to join a committee for dealing with employment. During Mrs. Webb's tenure on the Royal Commission, she laid down the first blueprint of cradle-to-grave Social Security to eradicate poverty without toppling the whole social structure. She lived to see Beveridge promulgate her major ideas in the historic Beveridge Report, from which they were brought to life in post-World War II Britain and the United States. Fabian practitioners developed Hegelian principles, which they co-taught alongside Morgan bankers and other important financial allies over the first half of the 20th century. One insightful Hegelianism was that to push ideas efficiently, it was first necessary to co-opt both political left and political right. Adversarial politics, competition was a loser's game. By infiltrating all major media, by continual low-intensity propaganda, by massive changes in group orientations, accomplished through principles developed in the psychological warfare bureaus of the military, and with the ability, using government intelligence agents and press contacts, to induce a succession of crises, they accomplished that astonishing feat. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, from Chapter 9, The Cult of Scientific Management. When I speak of Fabianism, or of any particular Fabians, actual or virtual, like Kurt Lewin, once head of Britain's Psychological Warfare Bureau, or R.D. Lang, once staff psychologist at the Tavistock Institute, I have no interest in mounting a polemic against this particular conceit of the comfortable intelligentsia. Fabian strategy and tactics have been openly announced and discussed with clarity for nearly a century, whether identified as Fabian or not. Nothing illegal about it. I do think it a tragedy, however, that government school children are left in the dark about the existence of influential groups with complex social agendas aimed at their lives. I've neglected to tell you so far about the role stress plays in Fabian evolutionary theory. Just as Hegel taught that history moves faster toward its conclusion by way of warfare, so evolutionary socialists were taught by Hegel to see struggle as the precipitant of evolutionary improvement for the species, a necessary purifier eliminating the weak from the breeding sweepstakes. God, I've never heard any socialists say anything like that. But we continue. Society evolves slowly toward social efficiency all by itself. Society under stress, however, evolves much faster. Thus, the deliberate creation of crisis is an important tool of evolutionary socialists. Does that help you understand the government school drama a little better? Or the well-publicized doomsday scenarios of environmentalists? Well, doomsday scenarios of environmentalists are quite valid. Well, anyway, we continue. The London School of Economics is a Fabian creation. Mick Jagger spent time there, so did John F. Kennedy. Once elitist, The Economist, now a worldwide pop intellectual publication, is Fabian, as is The New Statesman, and the Ruskin Labor College of Oxford. The legendary Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations, premier mind-bending institutions of the world, are Fabian. Theodore Adorno, an important if barely visible avatar of the therapeutic state and a one-time eminence at Tavistock, traveled the Fabian road as well. You needn't carry a card or even have heard the name Fabian to follow the wolf in sheep's clothing flag. Fabianism is mainly a value system with progressive objectives. Its social club aspect isn't for coal miners, farmers, or steam fitters. We've all been exposed to many details of the Fabian program without realizing it. In the United States, some organizations heavily influenced by Fabianism are the Ford Foundation, the Russell Sage Foundation, the Stanford Research Institute, the Carnegie Endowments, the Aspen Institute, the Wharton School, and RAND. Wow, that's amazing, I insert. And this short list is illustrative, not complete. Tavistock underwrites or has intimate relations with 30 research institutions in the United States, all which at one time or another have taken a player's hand in the shaping of American schooling. Once again, you need to remember that we aren't conspiracy hunting, but tracking an idea, like microchipping an eel to see what holes it swims into in case we want to watch it later on. H.G. Wells, best known of all early Fabians, once wrote of the Fabian Project. The political world of the open conspiracy must weaken, efface, incorporate, and supersede existing governments. The character of the open conspiracy will then be plainly displayed. It will be a world religion. This large, loose, assimilatory mass of groups and societies will definitely and obviously attempt to swallow up the entire population of the world and become a new human community. The immediate task before all people, a planned world state, is appearing at 1,000 points of light. Generations of propaganda and education may have to precede it. Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote in his famous signature book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era in 1970, a piece reeking with Fabianisms. Dislike of direct popular power, relentless advocacy of the right and duty of evolutionarily advanced nations to administer less developed parts of the world, revulsion at populist demands for selfish self-government, homeschooling would be a prime example, and stress on collectivism. Brzezinski said in the book, "It will soon be possible to assert almost continuous control over every citizen, and to maintain up-to-date files containing even the most personal details about health and personal behavior of every citizen, in addition to the more customary data. These files will be subject to instantaneous retrieval by the authorities. Power will gravitate into the hands of those who control information." Close quote. In his essay, Brzezinski called common people an increasingly purposeless mass, and of course, if the army of children collected in mass schooling is really purposeless, what argument says it should exist at all? And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto is a former award-winning teacher who spent 3 decades in the New York City schools. He resigned in 1991 after concluding that schools were harming rather than helping children. He has since become one of the foremost advocates of homeschooling and self-directed education. You can find out more about Gatto, his projects, and download this book online at johntaylorgatto.com. That's GATTO.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests in MP3 at our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And thank you for listening.
Makes my guns talk the best. For the rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black best. Yes, they'll catch me napping one day and they'll kill me, and then I'll be gone, but it won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled, sir, by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spend out equal, just like in the Bible and the prophets suggest. But the men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like an unwelcome guest.